Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
One in four of us will suffer a mental illness at some point in our lives, and many of us would feel confident in the care of a psychiatrist if we needed one. But for those who fell ill centuries or even decades ago, the prospects of being truly helped by the treatments offered were dimmer, and arguably many people were actually harmed. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Psychiatry today is overwhelmingly viewed as a legitimate medical specialty. Mental illnesses and the drugs to treat them are carefully studied, and best practices call for patients to be cared for with respect and compassion. So how did the discipline transform itself from the province of snake oil salesmen and pseudoscientists to one that is, by all accounts, a medical science? Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman is here to talk about this. He is professor and chairman of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Neurosurgeons, director of the New York State Psychiatric Institute, and former president of the American Psychiatric Association. His new book is called Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry, and it's available now in paperback. Dr. Lieberman, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
You note that there's no anti-cardiology movement calling to eliminate heart doctors. There's no anti-oncology movement. What is it about psychiatry that causes some people who might benefit from care to view the profession with suspicion even into the 21st century?
In a word, I would say it's stigma. And stigma is basically kind of a mark of disgrace or disapproval. It's the scarlet letter on the dress of Hester Prynne or the mark of Cain. Stigma is, in essence, prejudice born from ignorance and fear. And I think that mental illness is something historically which inspired fear in people, and they look to physicians to try and explain it and cure it, like with all other human disease. But in the case of mental illness, it was difficult to do, and it took longer to be able to come up with some understanding of what causes mental illnesses and how to treat them in a way that was scientifically well-founded and therapeutically effective.
Right. Because those explanations were elusive, the earliest attempts to understand mental illness led a lot of people to the conclusion that the mentally ill were like possessed or cursed in some way. How did those conclusions affect the way mentally ill people were treated?
Well, they were scorned and they were treated punitively. Historically, there were supernatural, religious, or other types of imagined explanations for why people behaved in the way they did, which was unusual or abnormal, and they were ostracized from society or they were imprisoned. And it was only really in the 18th century with French psychiatrist Philippe Pinel, who's famously remembered as the person who liberated the mentally ill from being treated as basically social lepers. And he said, well, listen, these are illnesses, and we, even if we can't cure them, we must treat people humanely. And so he ushered in what then became known as the asylum movement, which was to create a safe community environment, usually outside of the centers of cities, that could house and structure the environment in which persons with mental illness were kept. And he introduced something which was called or translated from the French as moral therapy, but it was really a form of talk therapy, the first form of talk therapy, where the physicians and attendants in the asylum tried to engage individuals and to deal with them in a structured and socially acceptable way as a way of trying to mold their behavior. This wasn't terribly effective, but at the same time, it also treated them comfortably and protectively in terms of what had been done for hundreds of years before.
You're a psychiatrist yourself. I know that you believe that modern psychiatry can be transformative for people who are suffering. Why is it important to go back over the murky origins, the things that people today might not be so proud of that their predecessors did in trying to get to where we are?
Well, Chris, if we look at the issue just from a very pragmatic standpoint, human beings suffer from a variety of illnesses, and they affect all organ systems in the body, the heart, the lungs, the kidneys, the stomach. the liver. They also affect the brain. And in the case of the disturbances in the brain, which affect the higher evolved functions that mediate behavior and emotion and thinking, we know from epidemiologic studies that these are not rare disorders. They affect, as you mentioned, 1 in 4 people. That's 25% of the population will have diagnosable psychiatric disorders sometime in their lifetime. And they're very distressing, often disabling, and sometimes lethal. And they cost society hundreds of millions of dollars. So it behooves us to really try and do something about this. The problem is that we don't. And the reason we don't is because our society, including our government, including many parts of the healthcare system, are ambivalent about mental illness and psychiatry. And the ambivalence is born from the fact that they can't get over the fact that up until fairly recently, we had limited knowledge about really what happens in the brain and that can go wrong to produce a mental disorder. And we didn't have genuinely effective treatments. And we have carried these vestigial suspicions about the veracity of psychiatry, uncertainty and fear of mental illness forward. And just to put it in stark terms, the biggest barrier to getting any kind of treatment and relief from mental illness for millennia up until the latter part of the 20th century was lack of knowledge and lack of availability of effective treatment. It was like, you know, Alzheimer's disease or ALS. We didn't have treatments for these. And now we do. But old attitudes still persist even into our government. And our policies and healthcare financing and healthcare service delivery reflect this. So basically, this is the vestiges of stigma, of antiquated attitudes, and we have to get over it. And that was really the primary motivation for writing this book.
How did you choose this field as your career?
Well, that's an interesting question. I guess, you know, growing up a nice Jewish boy, I was destined to be a doctor, but not necessarily a psychiatrist. So on my way to medical school while in college, in my introductory psychology class, I read Freud, and that was really extraordinary. I mean, Freud was a brilliant man, and he was just a gifted writer. And anybody who reads his introduction to the theory of dreams or any of his books is captivated by his insights into the human mind and how it works. And it's like, you know, when you go into medical school and you're reading in your textbooks about different illnesses, you know, the syndrome that they talk about medical students always developing is every illness you read about, you get the symptoms
right.
of. Well, I was reading about Freud's theory of the mind and thinking, oh, this explains why I act like this. This explains why I do what I do. This explains my relationship to my parents or authority figures. And so it was really quite eye-opening and intellectually interesting. But at the same time, and I'm dating myself here, I was a child of the 60s, there was all this intellectual ferment and cultural change going on across the country and on campuses. And, of course, part of that was the use of mind-expanding, mind-altering drugs. So I have to admit, although I didn't inhale, I did imbibe some hallucinogen. And I experienced hallucinogens in the form of LSD. And what struck me about that wasn't so much the brilliant revelations and insights I had while I was tripping. Afterwards, when I read my notes the next day, which I thought were going to be, you know, under revealing the secrets of the universe and the mysteries of life, it turned out to be, you know, sophomoric gibberish. But what I was struck by was the fact that 50 micrograms of a pharmacologic substance could so profoundly alter a person's state of mind. And with mental illness, perhaps a similar phenomenon occurred. Well, that wasn't an original thought or insight. many people had that in terms of how neurochemical mechanisms might underpin mental disorders. But it was the juxtaposition of this profound experience of how chemistry or biology could affect the person you were and the way you viewed things and behaved, combined with the psychological insights provided by Freud. So when I went to medical school, I intuitively rotated through all the different services, but I was really, I think, taken with psychiatry and chose to pursue it.
For better or for worse, Freud has been a towering figure in the field of psychiatry. What do we do with him today in the modern era, now that we know a lot of his ideas, while passionately held, don't really bear up to scientific scrutiny?
Well, I think we revere, respect, and we read him. Freud was a genius and was a seminal figure in the history of civilization, comparable to Darwin, Einstein, because before Freud, there was no understanding of, or only the most rudimentary understanding of the human mind. Psychology hadn't even been born yet. Wilhelm Wundt, who is usually credited to be the founder of modern psychology, was a contemporary of Freud's, and he was a physician like Freud. Freud was a neurologist, and they both sort of began developing their ideas almost in parallel. But there was no understanding of the mind. The general thinking was is that everything you did and felt, you knew about, you were aware of, you had conscious awareness of, and you controlled your mind. Nothing was operating in the back, pulling the strings and influencing what you did. And it was a very simplistic model of the mind. Freud, just by dint of sheer observation of patients and his own imagination, developed what was the most profound model of the mind, and still really to date. I mean, many of his fundamental components of his theory still are relevant and used today. The idea of the unconscious, that we're not aware of everything that is influencing our behavior. The idea of components of the mind, the ego, the id, the superego. The idea that a individual from infancy to adulthood undergoes a process of psychological development in stages. The idea of defense mechanisms. These all emanated from Freud, and they're still relevant today. And they're actually being validated experimentally in the context of what we call cognitive neuroscience. But at the same time, like all idols, Freud had clay feet. And his clay feet, two of them, were these. First, he was a control freak, and he did not brook any dissent or deviation among his acolytes. So if they tried to innovate or introduce new ideas into his theory, he viewed this as disloyal. And the second thing, and this wasn't so much Freud as his followers, his theory was never subjected to experimental verification. It was never tested scientifically. So as a result, it had to be taken on faith and became dogma. And his followers, the Neo-Freudians, basically perpetuated this dogma and brooked no dissent.
My guest is Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, professor and chairman of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Neurosurgeons, and author of the book Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You mustn't think I have a closed mind. I have absolutely no objection to your studying telepathy or parapsychology to your heart's content. But I would make the point that our own field is so embattled that it can only be dangerous to stray into any kind of mysticism. Don't you see, we have to stay within the most rigorously scientific confines. You all right?
Yes, but I can't agree with you. Why should we draw some arbitrary line and rule out whole areas of investigation?
Precisely because the world is full of enemies, looking for any way they can to discredit us. And the moment they see us abandon the firm ground of sexual theory to wallow in the black mud of superstition, they will pounce. As far as I'm concerned, even to raise these subjects is professional suicide.
That was Viggo Mortensen and Michael Fassbender playing Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung in the 2011 film A Dangerous Game. We're speaking this hour with Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, former president of the American Psychiatric Association and professor and chairman of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Neurosurgeons. We're talking about his book, Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. How did Freud and his ideas gain such purchase on the practice of psychiatry within the United States specifically?
Well, that's a very interesting story, Chris. So many things in history are kind of accidents of fate and timing. Freud really came of age in the latter part of the 19th century and gained a coterie of followers largely from the Germanic-speaking countries, which really at the time was the intellectual center of medicine in the world. And his group of followers used to meet regularly in his home, and they began to disseminate his theory, their ideas of how to apply it therapeutically, the talking cure, and it began to spread through Europe. And he acquired additional followers like Jung in Switzerland and Ernst Jones in London. And it was gaining traction, but it wasn't spreading like wildfire. In 1908, Freud made his only visit to the United States. He was invited to give a series of lectures, and he and Jung sailed to the U.S., he gave a series of lectures which were attended by the intellectual leaders of medicine and many thought leaders in the U.S. Attended also. And he made a huge impression that people were just bowled over. He was not only a gifted writer, he was a gifted orator. And just the ideas he communicated and his oratorical ability had a real impact on people. And immediately medical schools began to try and focus some attention on his theory in their curriculum and possibly hiring a faculty person who was trained by him, sat at the feet of the master. So he sort of planted the seeds with that trip, but then returned to Europe, never to come back again during the war when everybody who was Jewish was trying to escape the Nazis. He went to England, where he lived out his life. But many of his colleagues and his closest followers came to the United States as a result of the war or the Nazi takeover of the German government leading up to it. And when they arrived in the U.S., they were treated as visiting dignitaries, as individuals who carried the knowledge by virtue of having been analyzed and trained by the master. And medical schools gave them appointments. They were accorded prominent roles, and many people referred to them as patients. So they immediately, gained a place of respect and influence. And following that, and this was done spontaneously, but also in a premeditated fashion, the followers of psychoanalytic theory is thought to consolidate their power by gaining positions of influence in American medicine or American psychiatric medicine. And through this process, they assumed the chairs of the most prestigious medical schools in the country. They also became the leader of the professional organization, the American Psychiatric Association. And in essence, over the period of the 1940s and into the 1950s, essentially every psychiatrist, not 100%, but 90-some percent of the individuals who were in the positions of authority in psychiatric medicine in the United States were psychoanalysts, meaning that they were physicians trained in psychiatry who had undergone specific training to be certified in psychoanalysis. And unfortunately, carrying on those two peccadilloes of Freud, his obsession with control and the fact that scientific verification was not pursued, in order to perpetuate this, it became a dogma. And it resisted any attempt to innovate. And innovation through scientific verification, replication, innovation is the sine qua non of the scientific method and how it's applied in medical research. So in psychiatry, when we get to the 1960s, where everything began to change, psychoanalysis was firmly in control, but its credibility was eroding, and it put psychiatry as a field at a point of crisis, which could have resulted in its basically ending as a scientific discipline of medicine.
So how did the focus begin to shift, if not entirely, at least partially, to the effects of brain chemistry?
You know, the again, these things seem to have a certain orchestration of fate, the convergence of events occurring. So who would have thought that World War II and the rise of Hitler would have influenced the course of world psychiatry? But that probably played a huge role in how American psychiatry became so enthralled and captivated by psychoanalytic theory and the Freudians or the neo-Freudians. But then post-World War II, in the 1950s, several things happened. One was the asylum movement, which had been started over a century earlier as a very humane development, had turned into basically a snake pit. Mental institutions where over 500,000 people in the United States were housed were horrific places. And the public was very uncomfortable with this. Journalists did exposés. The conditions were appalling. It offended the moral sensibility of the country. Secondly, medicine as a whole began to be more scientifically driven. Research was playing a greater role. The government had created the NIH. The NIH was funding research in medical schools across the country, and each discipline was moving forward by leaps and bounds with scientific progress, and psychiatry should be part of that, but it wasn't. And at the same time, just through sheer serendipity, what we call psychotropic drugs were discovered. So the first was in 1951 by a French researcher who discovered the first antipsychotic medication, chlorpromazine. And this was tested after some bit of difficulty in sort of getting it into the right hands. But when it was given to patients who had been mad, insane, out of their minds for years in hospitals, they began to become coherent and oriented and able to cooperate and obedient for the first time.
Let me just stop you for a second, because the idea of this never having responded to any of the standard treatments and in some cases the compassionate, really, concerted effort to help these people, what kind of moment was it to suddenly realize that there might be something that could work for patients?
Well, the best thing I could compare it to is if you've read Oliver Sacks' book Awakenings or seen the movie, yeah. It was like that. Hmm. It was an awakenings moment. It was even more impactful because in Parkinson's disease or in the case of encephalitis lethargica, which is what the Awakenings book was based on, the people who had suffered from it before they received L-DOPA hadn't been treated so barbarically, but with patients with psychotic disorders like schizophrenia, who were the beneficiaries of this new miracle drug, chlorpromazine, prior to that, they had either been incarcerated or they had been treated with what was called malaria therapy, which was when the doctor would inject the blood of soldiers returning from tropical environments who had contracted malaria into them to induce fevers, or maybe even lobotomies. So this was moving from the barbaric and ineffective to something that was truly therapeutic, and it was extraordinary. And in the wake of chlorpromazine, you also had the introduction of an antidepressant, a mood stabilizer for manic depressive illness, anxiolytics. And so in the span of a decade, a little over a decade, the field, the world, humanity, went from having a series of illnesses which affected a substantial number of people for which there had never been any genuinely effective treatment to now having the possibility of a number of them. And so for the majority of patients, this would change their lives.
It's really interesting to think, Dr. Lieberman, about the reality that, and this is not only the case in psychiatry, but it is notable there, we don't necessarily know why some of these medications work.
We don't know exactly why. We have a pretty good idea, though. I think what we don't know is what the root cause of the illness is. Mm. We know that the symptoms improve the symptoms. I mean, these treatments improve the symptoms. But just like aspirin will reduce a fever, it doesn't necessarily alleviate the underlying cause of the fever. Or pain medication will relieve pain, but it won't relieve the underlying cause of the pain. So we know that antipsychotics alleviate psychosis, but we don't know if that's the primary, the dopamine that it's acting on is the primary cause. Similarly with antidepressants, similar with mood stabilizers. And it doesn't work for everybody. It works for a substantial proportion and generally well over the majority of people, but it doesn't work for everyone, and it doesn't necessarily cure them. Most people will need to take medications on an extended basis, if not lifelong. But even though people will say, I'm not going to do that, if they had hypertension or if they had diabetes or if they have some type of metabolic condition, we will be on medications on an indefinite and often lifelong basis. So this is another example where the stigma or double standard applies.
How did the first edition of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, come about?
Chris, I'll answer that, but let me just add one caveat first pertaining to our discussion about medications. So what's happened is that psychiatrists, among the different types of criticisms they incur, have now been often branded pill pushers and just wanting to treat people with medications instead of using other non-pharmacologic form of treatments. And that simply is not the case. I mean, it may be that healthcare reform and the idea of cost containment that our government policies have pushed doctors into has limited the amount of time that doctors have to interact with patients. But psychiatry was and still is, even in the era of neuroscience and psychopharmacology, a discipline which is very much engaged in the use of what are called psychosocial therapies, doctor-patient relationship, and the use of all other modalities, medications included, to treat it. So I reject the notion that we've turned into sort of a specialty of basically pill pushers.
Do psychiatrists, though, and now I'm diverting from my previous question, but do psychiatrists have the same, 11 minutes of FaceTime per visit per patient that doctors in a lot of other specializations have, or do you have significantly more time with each patient?
It really depends on the setting you're seeing them in. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we have a very inequitable healthcare system, and our healthcare financing process and policy is the reason for it. If I were seeing a patient for depression, for schizophrenia, for panic disorder, for obsessive compulsive disorder, I would be seeing them for evaluation of medication, but also providing whether it's exposure therapy, CBT, or some other type of talk therapy. However, because psychiatrists, having been trained for many, many years and have more rarefied and extensive expertise, because if they cost more, then what the healthcare system is pushing us to do is to fragment or separate the care. So doctors write the prescription, and then the social worker, psychologist, or master's level mental health care professional provides the therapy, because the cost is less. It's not ideal, but that's the situation. And on the other hand, if somebody has generous insurance or somebody's paying out of pocket, the doctor will spend as much time as they have. I hate to reduce it to business, but it fundamentally does turn on economics.
Are the working relationships pretty good when a psychiatrist chooses to, for lack of a better word, sort of outsource that care to someone who can provide it for less money?
Sometimes it depends on how good the clinic or the program is that's providing treatment. The reality is, and this is my big in the season of presidential election. It's timely. My big gripe is with the government and how it does not enact an enlightened policy to provide and finance health care. It's one thing if we don't have knowledge and the ability to alleviate illness, improve productivity, quality of life, and hold down cost of health care. But it's another when we do have the knowledge and we're not using it. And that simply is the case when it comes to health care in the United States, and particularly mental health care.
We're speaking this hour with the former president of the American Psychiatric Association, professor and chairman of psychiatry, at Columbia University College of Physicians and Neurosurgeons, Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman. His book is called Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. We will talk about the DSM in just a couple of minutes. You can join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman, former president of the American Psychiatric Association and professor and chairman of psychiatry at Columbia University College of Physicians and Neurosurgeons. His book is called Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. One of the stories you tell is that of the creation of the DSM, which is as complex as some of the disorders that it describes and catalogs.
Yes. I'm not going to dodge the question, but I want to just digress one second first just to say what you were asking before about, given the limitations of our healthcare financing, how well does it work if the doctor prescribes the medicines and someone else provides the psychotherapy or the rehabilitation therapy? And the U.S. News and World Report does rankings of hospital, and I'm proud that this year our hospital, New York Presbyterian Hospital, is ranked number one in psychiatry. And the reason I think that was the case was because exactly what you're referring to, how do we adapt to our healthcare financing system and still provide the best quality of care, given the constraints and inefficiencies it imposes on us. And the whole idea is to work around the clunkiness of our healthcare policies in order to provide the best care that our knowledge about mental illness and treatment enables us to do. And that's the additional kind of challenge that people in administrative positions like myself are required to do. And ultimately, hopefully, the policies will get better and enable that to be done more easily. But until then, it requires this degree of sort of improvisation. In terms of DSM-5, It's a very interesting story, very, I think, characteristic of what the checkered history of psychiatry has been. Since the discipline's birth at the beginning of the 19th century, the brain doctors, which split into neurology and psychiatry, psychiatry had a near-death experience in the 1960s, as we were talking about before. And at that time, with challenges to its credibility because of the failure of psychoanalysis, the scandalous quality of mental institutions, and it was like an emperor's new clothes discovery when the new science and medications began to, the value began to be appreciated. The APA called an emergency meeting, and they came up with something to rescue the field, which was to establish a rigorously devised manual of psychiatric diagnoses called the DSM. And they recruited a psychiatrist who actually was at Columbia some decades earlier, Robert Spitzer. And Robert Spitzer is a heroic figure in that he took the previous so-called Bible of psychiatry diagnoses and he put them into a context where only those that were supported by empirical data were sustained, and he had each of them described in exquisite detail so there could be no deviation from doctor to doctor in how they diagnose people. In 2005, the APA, because 20 years had elapsed since the last one, decided to undertake another revision to the DSM, which was then DSM-4. And in doing so, this provided a opportunity, because this was now 2005, the age of the internet, 24-hour news cycles. This provided an unprecedented opportunity for critics of psychiatry to weigh in on the process and take potshots at the field. And the kind of things that were alleged were that by developing this long list of different mental disorders, psychiatry was pathologizing normal behavior. It was creating fictitious disorders so it could treat people and make more money. It was creating conditions to aid and abet the pharmaceutical industry to develop drugs to make lots of profits from and give these to patients under false pretenses, and that the doctors were colluding with the pharmaceutical companies through conflict of interest. And so it caused over the eight-year period that the DSM was being revised before it was launched, really a pitched battle in the media in which psychiatry was really not reflected very, very well. It, you know, as luck would have it, the culmination of that coincided with my presidency of the APA. So a big part of my challenge was how to complete the revision of the DSM and to launch it successfully and at the same time try and enable psychiatry to hold its own in the court of public opinion through the media.
So what was important to you to do that successfully?
Well, it was basically trying to get out the truth. It's as simple as that. It's just to say what this is. And that was really the premise of the book. And this experience really was what motivated me to write the book. Look, we can't deny the realities of the past, and we're not being apologists. We're not trying to sweep it under the carpet. Psychiatry, in terms of medical specialties, was kind of the runt of the litter, the late bloomer of the field. And in the process of trying to understand the brain, what the cause of these disorders was, how to treat them, a lot of things that either seem barbaric or preposterous were done. But that was then, and now is now, and it's completely different. And so to continue to vilify the field and deny millions of people access to care in a way that's unfair, it makes no sense. It doesn't help the people, and it's not dealing with the field of medicine in an appropriate way. So in terms of trying to defend the DSM-5 during that process, it was simply trying to put out the truth and to say, look, does anybody deny there's such things as mental disorders? You know, look on the streets where the homeless are. Look in your families if you see people who have problems with addiction or with depression or anxiety or suicide or dementia or autism. It's all around us. These aren't remote, rare conditions. So if they are illnesses, how do we define them? And then how do we study them? And how do we treat them? And you can say what you want about the DSM, but it's a good faith, scientifically driven effort by medicine to try and establish a taxonomy of these conditions that can be used by healthcare providers everywhere.
One memorable misstep from earlier editions of the DSM, not the DSM-5, was the assessment that homosexual orientation, sexual orientation, was a form of mental illness. How did that contribute to stigma against gays and lesbians, and was it enough to sort of change that later on? Was there something, was the psychiatric profession, do you think, in publishing that statement, culpable in stigma against people who are attracted to those of the same sex?
Well, it was culpable, but it was really, I mean, was one of many things that the field was culpable of. From Freudian theory, many things were done in the guise of diagnosis that were culpable. For example, there was essentially a blame the parent trend in explaining what caused depression, what caused schizophrenia, what caused autism, the schizophrenogenic mother, the refrigerator mother, the weak, effeminate, or effete father. So these theoretical confabulations to explain a diagnosis was culpable. So when you talk about homosexuality, that was another one. But in this case, it wasn't psychiatry that came up with this. Psychiatry's culpability was allowing itself to be used as an instrument of social prejudice, in the same way that the Soviets used psychiatry to diagnose as mentally ill political dissidents. Our society was intolerant of homosexuality, of you know, non-conventional sexual orientation, and psychiatry colluded in creating a disorder to diagnose this. And the irony was is that one of the major kind of theorists in the cause of homosexuality, the Freudian theory of homosexuality, Charles Socarides, his son was gay and turned out to be the first gay, openly gay person in the highest ranking position in the U.S. government. So again, Robert Spitzer, who presided over this seminal reorganization of the DSM in the 1970s, was the person that actually oversaw the elimination of homosexuality as a mental disorder.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Mike on the line in Arlington. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call today. I have a sister who recently developed a mental illness in later age, and it may be schizophrenia, it may be something else, but it's a serious mental illness. And a lot of people like myself didn't know a lot about how people were treated or how they were treated by the healthcare system. As the doctor was talking about, it's pretty clunky. And it's virtually impossible to get help for someone unless they volunteer for help. And, of course, they have a mental illness, so they're not thinking rationally anyway. And yet we can't really force them to get treatment unless they become a menace to society or a danger to themselves or others. And I think a lot of people in our community just aren't aware of how little help there is and how relatives or other friends' hands are pretty tied when it comes to trying to get help for someone, even if you're willing to pay for it.
Mike, thank you so much. I'm sorry for the situation that you find yourself in and your sister as well. Dr. Lieberman, any thoughts for people in that situation?
Well, Mike's articulating what's probably the most difficult challenge that we face, which is that, you know, if you have a stomach ache or you are short of breath or you have some pain on urination, you know, you have symptoms and you decide what to do. When you have a mental disorder, it's the organ that's affected that has to make this judgment. And all too frequently, individuals don't think they're ill. They think their symptoms are real. And even if they did think those were symptoms, they wouldn't necessarily want treatment. And the United States, our ethos is founded on, you know, personal autonomy, self-determination, the rights of the individual. And we're reluctant to abridge those. And what we do is we elevate the rights of the individual over really the rights of society. And it's not helpful to either the individual or society. And the only time we really confront this is when there's imminent danger that the person poses to themselves or other people. But oftentimes this is too late and something bad happens anyway, or they've ruined their life or disrupted their life and all the time leading up to that point. So my recommendations to people, and I talk to people literally every other day about this from all walks of life, the most prominent and successful to people who are you know, struggling to get by and the least educated, but they all face the same problems. How do you get your loved ones to accept help if they need it? And you have to coax and you have to pressure and you have to find some way to lead them to a healthcare provider. There are organizations that can advise. The National Alliance for the Mentally Ill has branches in virtually every part of the country. To call them and ask for assistance, you should be able to call the Department of Psychiatry at the local medical school and say, who is working with patient advocacy organizations or consumers needing help and can assist me in advising this problem? We just spent like a week with a very prominent journalist about their child who is in her early 20s, clearly sick, and won't accept treatment. And I mean, if you say to me, what's the solution to this, I'll go out on a limb and say, I think we need to take a more unilaterally directive approach to enabling people to receive treatment even if they don't want it.
We just have a few seconds left. Do you think that the future of your profession is unquestionably brighter than the past?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question. The only question is sort of how long will it take us to come out of the shadows and to enjoy what would be called, you know, a unstigmatized, you know, comparable regard as other disorders. But look, you know, throughout history, this has been the case. We had leprosy, we had smallpox, we had cancer, we had tuberculosis, we had AIDS. AIDS is a new disease. When I was training, we saw the first cases in the late 1970s, but there was such an outcry and money was poured into research that by 1984 they discovered the HIV virus, and by 1987, AZT, the first treatment, was introduced. Rock Hudson was diagnosed in 1984 with AIDS, and he was dead within a year. Magic Johnson was diagnosed with AIDS in 1991, and he's leaving a perfectly normal life undergoing treatment. Mental illness will only get better, and psychiatry will be there to help.
The new book by Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman is called Shrinks, The Untold Story of Psychiatry. Dr. Lieberman, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.